Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're
Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. And
hooray.
Today, Pete, what are we talking about? What are we talking about?
We're talking about HMS Warspite in the Second World War. It's an exciting topic. Lots of general mayhem in the Mediterranean and Norway, all sorts of places.
Speaking of general mayhem, you've been to the lavatory, haven't you?
I have. You're quite
comfortable now.
I am comfortable. I've seen to everything. Has Fred taken you for your walk?
Fred's taken me for my walk, and we're all raring and ready to go.
Right, let's get going.
So where did we leave Warspite? Because this is our second one, isn't it?
Yeah, we did one on HMS Warspite in World War One, or the Great War, as we normally call it. We left her sort of, she was battered, but still afloat, just about, after the Battle of Jutland in 1916. She underwent a series of repairs, and she was back with the 5th Battle Squadron by July 1916. So she was only out for a couple of months, but then was probably in a collision with HMS Valiant at Scapa Flow on the 24th of August, which put her out of action for another couple of months.
Well, she well, a lucky ship. Yeah.
Lucky Warspite, they used to call her. Now, we ought to point out who she... The Warspite was one of the super dreadnoughts of the Queen Elizabeth class. And they were... Now, can you remember any other ones, Gary? I've written them down to remember them, but that was my job. I just wonder whether you can remember
the name. Well, Valiant, for one that she managed to crash into.
Yes, that's one.
And three others.
Barum, 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 barum. The Queen Elizabeth, I'm surprised you didn't get that one. And the Malaya, which was paid for by the Federated States of Malaya, I think.
And when were they laid down, Pete?
They were laid down, roughly speaking, in 1914. Their first appearance was in 15. Yeah. And the 8 15-inch guns, the most up-to-date engines of the time, fantastic, proper armour protection, which, of course, is why the Warspite survived Jutland when she was pounded by most of the German fleet. There's a thundering below. I can hear boom, bang, a bang, boom, bang, a bang, boom, bang, yeah.
So what did they do for the rest of the war, Pete? Because 1916 was quite active, but what about 1917
onwards?
Nah,
not much going on, really. They're the same for the rest of the Grand Fleet. Nothing much happens. Not much happened, and it happened slowly for the lads on the ships, for the most part. Then, 7th of February 1918, by this time the Warspite, the flagship of the 5th Battle Squadron, had another lucky incident. What was that, Gary?
Well, the lucky ship had a severe fire in the port engine room, Pete.
So, more damage,
and another visit to the dockyards.
Oh dear. Those dockyard Johnnies must be tired of seeing the Warspite. Then the Warspite, it's back in time for the surrender of the German High Seas Fleet when they sail into the Firth of Forth. Magnificent, there's photographs of it. It's really a great moment in naval history, the formal surrender of the fleet on the 21st of November 1918. Remember that, because in a way that we come back to that, because there's something similar happens in the Second World War. Now, what happens after the war? Well, Warspite and her sister ships, they're the second battle squadron now. They're in the Atlantic Fleet from 1919 to 1924. Lots of cruises to Gibraltar, annual exercises in the Mediterranean. Terrible life.
Terrible life.
But then there's a defence cut. So what is it that really impacts on the Royal Navy at this time? What is it that just makes a hell of a difference?
Well, there's the Washington Conference Agreement of 1921, Pete, which limits the relative sizes of navies and also the size of new battleships. So, in effect, the Royal Navy's cut to ribbons, but the Queen Elizabeth class is retained.
Now, part of what goes on, they retain them, but the Warspite undergoes a major refit, which takes 2 years. When I say refit, it's almost a rebuilding. Why do you think they put an anti-torpedo bulge on the sides?
To stop torpedoes sinking them.
Yes, yeah.
Now, this is 1924-26, isn't it, Pete?
Yeah. Her two funnels, her beautiful shape is to some extent ruined. She was a beautiful-looking ship. Two funnels linked into one. You've only got one funnel, haven't you?
I have.
And a remodeled bridge structure.
I've got one of them as well.
Hell of a bridge. And anti-aircraft pom-pom guns are put on. Why anti-aircraft pom-pom guns? What's becoming more of a threat as the years pass by?
Submarines.
Aircraft.
Aircraft
submarines.
Now, this means that displacement rises, doesn't it, Pete, to 31,000 tonnes. So as a result, presumably, it affects her speed.
It does. She goes down to about 22, 23 knots.
Still relatively fast.
About 24 knots before, 23 to 24 before. There's always some doubts about that. Now, refit completed, she goes on to serve intermittently flagship of the Mediterranean Fleet, based in Malta from 1926. Then she joins the Atlantic Fleet in 1930. And then there's a bit more exciting, which is caught up in the Invergordon, lucky old Warspite, caught up in the Invergordon Mutiny. And this reminded me, in fact, I went and bought it on eBay. A local East Finchley lad, he's about 80 now, Alan Herrera, wrote a book on the Invergordon, and that was one of the first things I ever catalogued at the War Museum, with the series of interviews he gave to the War Museum. And that was quite a trip to the past, seeing all that, remembering.
It's not all about you, Pete.
Is it not? And anyway, March 1933, another collision. Warspite, the Dodgem, I would call her. She doesn't seem to go. I wonder if Leslie Phillips had some, you know, the left hand down, the Navy knot, left hand down a bit. This time with a Romanian steamer. I don't know. It's better than a green streamer.
Probably didn't see it coming.
Yeah. More exercises, more tours, various countries, showing the flag, visits to British. Obscure British ports to show the flags in primitive places like Glasgow and, you know, Edinburgh, places, you know, beyond the ken of mortal man. And then war clouds. So another modernisation. This is a big one. This is from December 33 into 37. That's how many years is that, Gary?
That's 4 years. Now, she's gutted the midships, Pete, and both underwater and deck protection are improved against the battleship's main enemies, which by this time are developing to be mines, torpedoes and bombs.
Other battleships' guns, yeah.
Yeah. Now, more anti-aircraft guns are fitted, she could also now carry a couple of aircraft. She's not an aircraft carrier, but just a couple of small aircraft.
She's got a hangar and a couple of seaplanes or float planes or whatever you call them, yeah. Now, the guns are modified as well. The guns are good anyway, 15-inch bangy things. What do they do?
Yeah, but they modify it to allow greater elevation, so that gives an improved range of about 32,000 yards. Now, what's
that
in miles, Pete?
That is about 24 miles.
18 miles, Pete. Now, to reduce the weight to compensate, more modern high-pressure boilers and turbines are also fitted.
So they'd be lighter but provide the same engine power.
Yeah.
A lot lighter, wouldn't they?
And a new lighter bridge structure and the removal of 4 6-inch guns.
Those are the ones on the side.
And the torpedo tubes.
All right, they're not necessary. Now, the displacement goes up to 32,000. That's another 1,000. So she's not quite such a good sailor. She's got what you might want to explain it, what a low freeboard is, but I think it means it's nearly sinking. An impaired below deck ventilation, but she could still just about make 24 knots now, because all the changes and everything were sort of counterbalancing each other. Now, there's a problem though. Now, this you'll be surprised to hear this. Guess what goes wrong, or what starts to become a problem from then to the end of her time?
Well, despite it being a 4-year program, the dockyard program's actually been rushed and
towards the back end of it,
and the Warspite has recurrent steering problems. Now, especially in top speed manoeuvring. And, in fact, this caused a bit of a delay in acceptance.
Now, this new Warspite, and when I say new Warspite, it is almost a new ship. It's made flagship of the Mediterranean Fleet, based at Malta in 1938. Loads of working up exercises, and the gunnery, the new gun provision, they're still deadly accurate. They'd always been accurate, they're deadly accurate, and that will be a feature of the Warspite's career. The war comes, September 1939, for the British, and it's quite quiet, isn't it, the opening months in the Mediterranean. Remember, the Italians aren't in the war, and I can't think of any German ports on the Mediterranean. Not offhand. who's the Warspite's a flagship of the Mediterranean Fleet. So who's the admiral? Because he's going to feature a lot in this, isn't he?
Yeah, it's Vice Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham, who's based initially at Alexandria.
Oh, well, that's in Egypt.
Yeah. Now, the Royal Navy had 12 battleships at that time, of which 10 were the Queen Elizabeth or R class.
That's the Royal Sovereign... I can't remember the names of the other ones. The Royal Sovereign class.
Yeah, which are great warships, aren't they?
Yeah, Ramillies and things
now,
like that.
Probably. The only modern battleships were the Rodney and the Nelson.
That's which... what could confuse me. That also begins with R. That's not...
Now, they date back to the early 1920s.
Well, that's interesting, because the Warspite's been rebuilt since then, so in some ways the Warspite's more modern, perhaps not. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, she had the range and speed of any of the battleships there at the time. There were less German ships, for example, but they were on the whole more modern.
This is the Bismarck and Tirpitz. I don't know where they've been launched then, but they're on the horizon.
You've got the German pocket battleships, haven't you, such as the Graf Spee and the battlecruisers like the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau. I never know how to say that.
That's right.
Because of Ganache.
Ganache. The pocket things like pocket battleships are their means of avoiding the Washington Treaty, aren't they? That's what's going on there. Now, those ships, all three of them, the Graf Spee, Scharnhorst, Ganache, they can't be caught by British battleships. And the only ones that really bothered them were the faster British battlecruisers. And you'll have heard of one of them. Garrick, can you name one British?
Well, certainly the Hood was one. I think... the Renown and the Repulse.
That's it. Ooh, wow. Your memory's picking up. It's really brilliant. Now, October 39, Warspite's withdrawn from the Mediterranean and goes on convoy escort duties in the Atlantic, based at Greenock, which I never knew where it was.
It's near Glasgow. Yeah, it's near Glasgow.
Is it Glasgow's port? I think it is.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. And after the Nelson damaged by a mine, not the Warspite, but there's something going wrong.
She's probably steered towards it and missed.
Yeah. That's right. She had a period as flagship of the Home Fleet. So the Warspite is a very important ship at this time. Phony War ends on the 9th of April 1940. The Germans invade Norway and they attack the 6 main ports, of which the most northern is Narvik. And that's assaulted by a small army group with 10 large 5-inch gun destroyers. They're better than our destroyers, aren't they? And elements of the Home Fleet are sent to intercept them, including the Warspite. Now, that was just about to be returned to the Mediterranean Fleet, but it's sent off on this mission. And there's two battles of Narvik, aren't there? Take me through the first battle of Narvik. So there's the ten German destroyers. They're in the fjord. What happens to them on the 10th of April?
Well, on the 10th of April, they're attacked by 5 smaller British H-class destroyers, which have got 4.7-inch guns. Now, at first, they took the Germans by surprise and they sank a couple of destroyers. But as more Germans emerged, the outnumbered British lost 1 and suffered severe damage.
Now, bit of a draw, really, isn't it?
Yeah, in essence, it's a draw as the Germans fail to press home their numerical advantage.
Ooh. Now, the second Battle of Narvik is 3 days later. I've just worked that out in my head.
Yes, that's the 13th of April.
Yes. Please. Unlucky for some, Gary. And this is, we've got some quotes about this. We're going to go into, because this is quite a battle, isn't it? The British return, but this time they've got the Warspite and 9 destroyers. And you've got a picture of the scene, Gary. Gary, I want to set the picture. A picture in your mind. Freezing bloody cold. Cloudy night. It's a cloudy night. Flurries of snow. The decks of the warships covered in ice. And visibility down to about 10 miles.
Oh. Sounds like May 2021.
It does sound like it, yeah. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, Warspite starts a journey up the Narvik fields. They've got 3 destroyers in front, they've got minesweeping gear. Now, where are the other 6, Gary?
Well, the other 6 are stationed 3 on either side. But it's still a real gamble.
Why?
Pete.
Why is it a gamble?
Well, you've not only got German destroyers, but what about U-boat threat?
So and then there's the mines, of course. So it's a double mine threat and, a double torpedo threat and mines.
Yeah, now you're going to be Lieutenant Patrick Hoare of HMS Warspite.
The captain accordingly addressed the ship's company on the plan and also the attendant dangers that would ensue on the following day, which started with a special Holy Communion at 8 a.m, attended by some 300, the average of a Sunday being about 20. How often was one to see in the future celestial insurance policies being taken out before impending danger? Celestial prayers, celestial insurance policy. I like that. That's a nice one. Now, the Warspite is a deadly warship, and the aircraft carried aboard it seems to be pretty deadly as well. And they have a Swordfish float plane, and this is commanded by Lieutenant Commander W.L.M. Brown, and it's launched from the Warspite to scout ahead. And what a flight it was. What a fight it was. What an excitement. They warned the Warspite of hidden destroyers on the flanks. Because a field has lots of sidey bits. Other fields. Fields of fields of fields of fields. And then this aircraft sights a U-boat, in one of the side fields. And it's waiting. It's going to launch its torpedoes at the Warspite. Well, the pilot left an account, because although Brown was the commander, the pilot was Petty Officer Airman Frederick Rice. And he says this. What does he say, Gary?
The Swordfish carried an assorted bomb load, 250-pound high-explosive bombs, 200-pound anti-submarine bombs and 840-pound anti-personnel bombs. U-64 was seen on the surface at the top of Hardingsford. I selected the 2 anti-submarine bombs and put the Swordfish in a dive and released the bombs at 200 feet. I couldn't see the bombs fall as we pulled out, but Pacey saw the starboard bomb fall close alongside and the port one hit just abaft the conning tower.
Abaft!
Now, abaft means behind, Pete.
Avast behind.
The U-boat was already sinking when I could see her again.
Now, that's Pacey, by the way, was the other member of the crew. He'd be the wireless operator, I presume. That's quite a thing, isn't it? The Warspite's float plane was the first U-boat of the war, sunk by a naval aircraft. It's quite something. And she then, the Swordfish, continues its recce and sends back vital information, where exactly those bloody German destroyers are, by wireless.
Now, that actually points to the importance of the refit, Pete, because without that refit, she wouldn't have had that plane.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that. There you go. Then there's another scare. There's another U-boat. The warship is sort of a mixture of luck, isn't it? This stalking U-boat, it's a submerged rock and bobs to the surface. And by the time they've got themselves sorted out, they've lost their chance. The warship and the destroyer.
So warships, Warspite's still a lucky ship.
Oh, lucky.
Lucky Warspite.
Lucky Warspite. Then they go up the fjord, and there's a series of running encounters with the German destroyers as they emerge from the various side fields and inlets. It's very exciting. And the defending destroyers, the 9 of them, are firing at them, and the Warspite enthusiastically joins in. As the 15-inch guns blaze out, there's something important about this. What's that?
Well, it's the first time that her main armaments fired in anger since the Battle of Jutland, Pete, in 1916.
That's a long time, isn't it?
It is a long time. Now, here's a quote from Petty Officer Daniel Reardon of HMS Warspite, and you're going to be Daniel Reardon on this occasion, Pete. What does he say?
A terror officer tells me out loud. We hear the order repeated to the men down below. The cages come up with a thud and out go the rammers. Suddenly comes the order, salvos, and the right-hand gun comes to the ready. Then enemy in sight and the sight setters chant out the ranges. It is like a practice shoot. Our guns are nearly horizontal, so the range must be short. Then the ding-ding of the fire gong. The right gun moves a little, comes steady, and there's a woof which rocks the turret. The left gun is now at the ready and fires while the right gun is reloading. The turret fills with smoke like London on a November night. The turret officer calls out, "Tell the crew we have hit a destroyer and she's burning nicely. Good work, boys. Keep it going. Steady firing now." Then the trainer reports, "Blimey, another one has got it."
Wow.
Quite exciting, isn't it? Let's just give them an idea. How much does the one shell weigh?
Well, it's approximately 1 ton.
So, can you imagine a destroyer with its thin little sides being smashed by one of these?
Well, there's a phrase, isn't there? It would have gone through a destroyer like a hot knife through butter. I mean, that's rather apt.
Yes, and you're going to be Able Seaman H. Banks.
We couldn't miss at that range. Imagine, if you can, 4 15-inch shells, each weighing a ton, packed with high explosive, hitting a thin-skinned destroyer.
Now, when the firing stops, and it doesn't last long, obviously it doesn't last long with 1 ton shells smashing at the destroyers, the gun crews are allowed to come up on top of the turrets. And this is Petty Officer Daniel Reardon again. "There is a sight, burning and sinking enemy ships all around us, and our own destroyers searching into every little corner that might hide something." I seem to have gone from Australian to
Australian to Cornish. I was going to comment on the accent.
I was going for Cockney, but I forgot.
You missed.
I forgot what Cockney sound like.
Me.
Oh, yeah.
Ish.
Right, so what have they done? What have they achieved, Gary, at the end of the day?
Well, in all, they'd sunk 8 destroyers, 1 U-boat, and they'd also damaged shore batteries and installations. Now, there was a cost.
There was a cost, wasn't
it? It was at the expense of 3 damaged destroyers.
Now, it's a thought that if a landing force had been with them, in other words, you know, behind them, that the Narvik could have been captured. But there's no point in risking. They can't leave the Warspite there, because why not?
Well, because, as you mentioned previously, she would be susceptible to air and submarine attack.
Yeah, that's it. So early on the 14th of April, so the Warspite withdraws. They come back and they carry out a shore bombardment on the 24th of April. But the Norwegian campaign, we're going to have to leave it because it's doomed. The Germans just have us for breakfast. Warspite goes back, peering in home waters, and then finally gets sent back to the Mediterranean, where it becomes the flagship again of Admiral Cunningham, who's a vigorous admiral. Vigorous.
Now, this is to face the new enemy, which at this point is now the Italians.
They've joined the war in what was it, June 1940? Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Now, there are other battleships out there, the Malaya, the Royal Sovereign, and the Ramillies. And there's an aircraft carrier, Pete, out there, the Eagle, and the usual screens of cruisers and destroyers. But, you know, they're facing a more modern or recently modernised Italian fleet.
Yeah, they've got a couple of cracking new ships, but also they've modernised their First World War pre-dreadnoughts. Warspite's next big adventure takes place on the 7th of July. Cunningham went to cover 2 convoys travelling from Malta to Alexandria. And he knows that the Italian fleet's out escorting its own convoy to Tripoli. What's Cunningham hoping to do, Gary?
Well, he's hoping to draw the Italians into battle by sailing towards Italy. So, in effect, cut them off from their home base at Taranto.
So he's trying to get between them and Taranto. What happens?
Well, the two fleets eventually meet at the Battle of Calabria on the 9th of July 1940. The Allied cruisers were outgunned in the early encounters, so Cunningham takes the Warspite forward to assist.
Whoa! So the Italian cruisers turn away under a smoke screen, but the battleships, Guido Cesare and Conte de Cavour, close on the Warspite before the Malaya and any other ships can catch up. This looks like the Warspite's in trouble again.
Yep. Then there's a near miracle, Pete.
Near miracle.
A truly stupendous long-range gunnery hit from a moving ship at a moving target hits the Guido Cesare at a range of approximately 26,000 yards.
Now, that's the Warspite does this with one of our 15-inch shells, isn't it? Now, you're going to be... yeah, I thought you might pick him. You're always the bosses. You're going to be Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham, and you're aboard the Warspite. What does he say?
The Warspite shooting was consistently good. I had been watching the great splashes of our 15-inch salvos straddling the target when, at 4 p.m, I saw the great orange-coloured flash of a heavy explosion at the base of the enemy's flagship's funnels. It was followed by an upheaval of smoke, and I knew that she had been heavily hit at the prodigious range of 13 miles. His ships turned away, and having discharged 17 salvos in all, the Warspite ceased firing, the whole western horizon being overlaid with a thick pall of smoke behind which the enemy became completely hidden. Pall or pall of smoke?
Pall, I think we'll go for.
Well, I think Scotsmen say pall.
Cheers. Get you, pal.
Yay, yay.
Now.
Now, that's quite a sensible account. But other people talk about Cunningham leaning over the side of the bridge, pointing out various Italian ships. And what's he say?
There's another bastard. Shoot that bastard up.
That's more like it. Anyway, what had they hit? Well, they'd hit the rear funnel of the Guido Cesare with fragments starting several fires, forced the boilers offline, and it took the Italian flagship speed down to 18 knots. Now, obviously, Cunningham doesn't know. They're not sure how bad the damage is, and they can see the Malaya and the Royal Sovereign coming into range. So the Italian fleet withdraw. They disengage and withdraw. They disengage behind the smoke screen. That's what Cunningham was talking about, the pall of smoke, or pall of smoke, if you're Scottish. I want to make this clear. If you read the various histories of the Warspite, there's loads more action, but we can only cover the highlights. What's the next highlight, Gary?
Well, the next
it's a big one,
Battle of Cape Matapan.
Yeah.
Now, the Mediterranean fleet's covering troop movements to Greece when Bletchley Park decoded the Italian naval enigma for the first time, which gives intelligence of the sailing of an Italian fleet comprising the Vittorio Veneto.
That's a cracking new ship, yeah.
Six heavy and two light cruisers, plus destroyers to attack the convoys.
Now, on 27th of March 1941, Cunningham goes to intercept. The next day, his cruisers run into the Italian fleet. Cunningham orders an airstrike, which caused the Italians to fall back. And then there's a series of airstrikes, which damaged the Vittorio Veneto and the heavy cruiser Pola. Now, the Vittorio Veneto escapes into the dusk. It's nighty time. And the British pursue through the night. And they manage to run down the Pola and her sister ships. That's the Fiume and Zara. Now, who runs them down? Well, that's the Warspite, Valiant and Barham. Barham, Barham, Barham. Aided by their searchlights. And one of those... this is quite interesting in view of recent events. Who's on board the Valiant that you might have heard of?
Well, the Valiant was commanded at that point.
By
the late Prince Philip. In your notes, Pete, you said that the Valiant was commanded by the late Prince Philip.
I knew you'd do that, but if you look, one of these searchlights.
Ah, I see. One of those on Valiant was commanded by the late Prince Philip.
Yeah.
We can cut all that out, Pete.
We can cut. I mean, mistakes are just something that happens.
Yeah, because
I personally don't make mistakes. I think someone pointed out recently that other than dates, people, pronunciations, place names, historical facts, and anything else, I'll get most things right.
And that is why, in many ways, I consider you a mentor. In many ways, I don't.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
I'm going to be Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham again. He's on board HMS Warspite, and he says, "I shall never forget the next few minutes. In the dead silence, a silence that could almost be felt, one heard only the voices of the gun control personnel putting the guns onto the new target. One heard the orders repeated in the director tower behind and above the bridge. Looking forward, one saw the turrets swing and steady when the 15-inch guns pointed at the enemy cruisers. Never in the whole of my life have I experienced a more thrilling moment than when I heard a calm voice from the director tower, 'Director Lair sees the target.' Sure sign that the guns were ready and that his finger was itching on the trigger. The enemy was at a range of no more than 3,800 yards, point blank."
And that's when the moment comes. It's an amazing moment for these people. I mean, it's death and destruction, but it is an incredibly exciting moment.
Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham goes on to say, "One heard the ting, ting, ting of the firing gongs. Then came the great orange flash and the violent shutter as the six big guns bearing were fired simultaneously. At the very same instant, the destroyer Greyhound switched her searchlights onto one of the enemy cruisers, showing her momentarily up as a silvery blue shape in the darkness. Our searchlights shone out with the first salvo and provided full illumination for what was a ghastly sight. Full in the beam, I saw our six great projectiles flying through the air. Five of the six hit a few feet below the level of the cruiser's upper deck and burst with splashes of brilliant flame. The Italians were quite unprepared. Their guns were trained fore and aft. They were helplessly shattered before they could put up any resistance."
Oh, it's quite a story, isn't it? So he's a bit overexcited, isn't he?
He is. But imagine the feelings of a young seaman. Now, I've carefully selected you to be boy seaman Roy Emmington of HMS Warspite. Can you think why that might be, Pete?
No. I think of the end of this quote. Watch out for it. Here we go. "I was in the X-Troops control cabinet. That was a night to remember because at night actions, the 15-inch turrets fired broadsides. Salvos shook the insides out of you, so you were wondering what the broadsides would do. We didn't have long to wonder. We got the orders to load both guns and we heard the breech workers shout, 'Ready!' And a few seconds after they fired, the feeling in a 15-inch turret firing broadsides will be hard to explain, especially the feelings of a 17-year-old boy. It took us hours on the mess deck to unwind that night."
Yes.
What could he mean?
Well, he was very young. He clearly hadn't gone through puberty based on your accent now.
Probably any East Finchley Boy Scout, mate.
Mm.
Right, so what happens to that? In a one way, this isn't funny, because this is one thing you have to remember in warfare. This is all very well from our perspective, if you're British. But what about the Italians on those ships? Because, you know, we're all friends together now. What happened to the lads on those three heavy cruisers?
All three heavy cruisers are destroyed. The Fiamme and Zara within a mere 2 to 3 minutes. You've said this before. When things go wrong at sea, Pete, they can go wrong very quickly. The Polar was already dead in the water and sinking, and it was finished off later. And two Italian destroyers were also sunk, all with a loss of some 2,400 Italian sailors.
And that isn't funny. Funny accents put aside for that. That's terrible. Now, an air recce shows that the rest of the Italian fleet had escaped. So the fleet goes back to Alexandria on the 29th of March, surviving air attacks. Now, this is a theme that, well, we're just going to pick out a quote, because air attacks are very common in the Mediterranean. And this is, he's in charge of air defence. He's in charge of the anti-aircraft guns on the Warspite. And he's Lieutenant Commander William Fitzroy. And you're going to read his quote.
"Bombs, bombs, bombs. Yet surprisingly, few ships were hit. I can only reach back to the sounding of alarm bells, to the whine of the forced draft fans as the ship rapidly increased speed, and to the wide swathes of bombs as they crossed and recrossed the fleet. Action stations, defence stations, and much more rarely, cruising stations, the lowest degree of readiness. one after the other, day in, day out. On one occasion, in an interval between air attacks, a tired bridge messenger accidentally tripped up and shot a jug of scalding cocoa down the back of my neck. My roar of pain coincided with the air raid red alarm bells. Captain Fisher turned round and said to me, "We seem to be rather noisy in our closing up today."
I wonder if he was a tired messenger or someone who didn't like him. "Oh, sorry, sir. It was an accident."
"Yes.
I apologise unreservedly."
Now, on the 22nd of May 1941, during the German invasion of Crete, the Warspite suffers...
Lucky Warspite suffers
severe damage in an air raid. Now, Jack Worth had a good view from his anti-aircraft pom-pom, and you're going to be Jack. What does Seaman Jack Worth of HMS Warspite say, Pete?
"This blob came away from under, beneath the German plane and hurtled my way. It was a bomb, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. It took out the 4-inch gun beneath me. I looked down. What had been there before was now gone, replaced by a gigantic hole and a mess of wreckage." Now, what had it done?
Well, the bomb damaged her starboard anti-aircraft 4-inch and her 6-inch secondary batteries, ripping open the ship's side and causing nearly 100 casualties. Now, Pete, you're going to be Marine Arthur Jones, also of HMS Warspite.
"All the air was blown out of my lungs. I started running and my feet were on fire. I think I wasn't killed because I wasn't where I should have been in the gun layer's position. My mate, the gun trainer, was in his position, and we never in this position, and we never found his body. It might have been washed overboard. Who knows? They were all my mates. There were 9 of us on my gun crew. One survived, me." And the executive officer rushes to the office into action. This is his job. This is where he becomes the key figure, assessing the damage, sorting out. And on this occasion, it's Commander Sir Charles Madden, well-known name. And he's on HMS Warspite. And you're going to read it.
"I saw dense smoke coming from the starboard 4-inch battery. On reaching the upper deck level, it was apparent that one 4-inch mounting had gone overboard completely and that the other was at an angle. There was a huge hole in the deck between the two mountings from which smoke and flame were pouring out. I then went down to the port 6-inch battery to see if fire parties were ready and to try to get at the seat of the fire through the armoured door that connected the port and starboard 6-inch battery decks. I found the fire party lined up ready by this door, asked 2 ratings to enter with me, and told the fire parties to open the door and follow us in. We had great difficulty in opening this door and had to use a sledgehammer. Finally, it gave to display a gruesome scene. The starboard battery was full of flames and smoke, in amongst which the cries of burned and wounded men could be heard. The flames seemed pretty fierce, and I was doubtful if we would make headway against them. However, my 2 volunteers came either side of me with their hoses and we walked into the battery."
Now, this is just like, remember our when we did the Jutland podcast, HMS Malaya's hitting a starboard battery and they go through trying to rescue. They manage to damp down the flames, don't they? And Madden says this:
"I felt confident that I could get the fires out, but was hampered by the continued cries of the burned men, which distracted the fire parties, who wanted to leave their hoses to assist their comrades. I therefore concentrated on administering morphia. As it was dark and wounded men were thrown in all directions amidst piles of ironwork and rubbish, this was not easy."
Now, where the 4-inch gun was, they could see, they're not out of the woods, there's still aircraft up above them, and Madden says this:
"We could see the deep blue sky and the next wave of attacking aircraft coming at us. The 4-inch battery being out of action made it seem unpleasantly quiet until the pom-pom started up, which caused a lot of broken ironwork to fall about. I can remember the pom-pom bursts filling up the area of sky. We could see and the aircraft still coming on, and some of the fire parties dropping their hoses to shake their fists at them."
Then that's not it. He has to rush off to another part of the ship. There's another emergency that, as executive officer, Madden has to deal with it.
"I then went to the starboard mess decks, where a fresh and unexpected scene of carnage greeted me. The armoured deck overhead, that of the starboard 6-inch battery, had been pierced by the explosion, the force of which had descended into a mess deck where communication ratings off watch were resting. These, contrary to instructions, and because of the heat, were lightly clad, and there were heavy casualties from burns. The great amount of water we had pumped into the battery above to put out the fires had poured into the mess deck, which was in parts knee-deep in water, thus adding to the confusion of scattered mess tables, lockers and bodies. Now, I had to pause a couple of times there because I got slightly confused because I had a bit of a feeling of deja vu and I was getting confused about who I was talking about. In the First War, there's a very similar account by Commander Humphrey Warwin on the war spy.
When she'd been turning round and all the damage she suffered, and he goes round all the various sites of the damage. And it's a very similar account, isn't it? Yeah. And you read Walwyn. I remember you did it in the Jutland podcast.
Yeah, so sorry for that.
And again, in the, of course, when we did the war spy for the First War.
But it just kept coming into my head. It was almost as if I was reading the same thing.
Very similar instance in many ways. I think there's more casualties in this than there were at Jutland. A lot more. It was a terrible incident. Now, she's going to need repairs after this. So in June 1941, she sets off to the Bremerton Naval Shipyard in the United States, which is neutral? Yes, it's neutral. Don't come in the water, December. But they're helping out, so to speak. So what happens there? What are they doing?
Well, repairs and modifications begin in August, which includes the replacement of deteriorated 15-inch guns.
That's from firing so much.
Yeah. Now, the addition of more anti-aircraft weapons.
Ever more anti-aircraft guns.
Improvements to the bridge, a new surface and anti-aircraft radar.
These are things that have come in during the war, so yeah. After sea trials, she joins the Eastern Fleet at Trincomalee. Where's that?
I have no idea where Trincomalee is.
Ceylon or Sri Lanka, whichever you want to use. March 42, and there she's the flagship of Admiral Sir James Somerville. Now, funny enough, we've not got much to say about this, have we?
No, because although it's a developing, threatening situation, this deployment's relatively calm. And after another quick refit at Durban, she returns to the UK in May 1943.
Now, she joins a famous force then, Force H, based at Scapa Flow, and then sails on 9th of June 1943 for the Mediterranean with five other battleships, two aircraft carriers and 12 destroyers. It's a big fleet for the Second World War. What's she covering? What could be happening in June?
She's helping to cover the Operation Husky Invasion of Sicily, which is in July 1943.
We did a podcast on that.
We did. Her main involvement was going to be the bombardment of Catania. Now, you've got a quote here.
I have.
This is Captain Herbert Packer of HMS Warspite. What does Herbert say, Pete?
A great mass of dust and smoke rose from the town, right on target. We had exactly 20 minutes to do our dirty work. Then everything happened at once. Two submarines appeared and were quickly depth-charged by our destroyers. Three FW-190s, Focke-Wulf 190s, got a load of Ehrlich and pom-pom 4-inch and 6-inch, but got away. They were moving about 400 mile per hour and machine gunning like fury, but with indifferent accuracy. The shore batteries opened up and the destroyers took them on as our big guns were pouring in the stuff. That's pouring in the firing at Catania. It was a fine 20 minutes for the old war spy. Right. She then goes back to Malta at high speed. And on the way, there's several air attacks, which her combination of her high speed and anti-aircraft defences means that she's lucky. Lucky war spy, we call her. Yeah. And she got a bit of a nickname from Admiral Cunningham here when he signals something. What does he do?
He signals, "Operation well carried out. There is no question when the old lady lifts her skirts, she can run." Now, in early September, the Warspite helped cover the assault across the Straits of Messina and Salerno landings. And on the night of 8th of September, she has another close shave.
That'd be off Salerno. And I'm going to be Captain Herbert Packer, who's commanding the Warspite. He says this: "I heard above the sound of our pom-poms, Ehrlichans, 4-inch and 6-inch guns, an aircraft roaring in. It skimmed down the safe edge of our barrage, about 40 degrees off the port bow. I saw this jet JU-88 drop its torpedo. I saw it splash. And down the voice pipe to the quartermaster, I roared, 'Port!'
35 degrees. It's, oh, 35, or whatever. It seemed 1,000 years before I saw the electric repeat from the rudder head showing that the rudder was 35 degrees to port. I can honestly say that I was holding on to things, waiting for the bump, and so was everyone else on the bridge. The bump, he means the thump of the torpedo. I steadied up with my course parallel to the track of the torpedo, and it literally missed the stern by fate. The parallel track was so close that I had to climb up on the side of the bridge and look over the edge to see it. Wow, wow. So that's lucky. That's lucky. So should we say she had mixed luck?
Yeah.
And then there's a sort of notable thing. The Italians surrender about this time, early September. And the Warspite has the honour of meeting and leading in elements of the Italian fleet, including the flagship Vittoria Veneta, the Italia, the Guido Cesare, for internment in Malta. And this is all echoes, isn't it? Echoes of November 1918. And Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham, who's in command of the Mediterranean fleet, says, not on the Warspite, but he watches it. What does he say?
It was a most moving and thrilling sight to see my wildest hopes of years back brought to fruition, and my former flagship, the Warspite, which had struck the first blow against the Italians 3 years before, leading her erstwhile opponents into captivity, filled me with the deepest emotion and lives with me still. I can never forget it. I made a signal congratulating the Warspite on her proud and rightful position at the head of the line.
And as I say, it's just like in 1918 when the German fleet surrendered. Now, Force H was recalled to the UK to begin preparations for D-Day. So the Warspite's in the thick of everything, isn't it? And the Warspite and the Valiant are there to provide support for the Allied forces. I'm going completely wrong. The Warspite and the Valiant are left behind. Sorry, I got confused there. And they're going to provide more support for the landings at Salerno. And I'm going to be Captain Herbert Packer, aren't I? What am I going to say? Well, let's hope I get it right, more right than that. Eh?
Faultless,
that's me. Fire was opened on enemy traffic concentrations and ammunition dumps. It must have been heartening to the hard-pressed soldiers to see the great ship steaming up and down only half a mile offshore, their guns belching flame, to hear the 15-inch shells screaming overhead, and then see the heavy explosions in the enemy lines. Do you think the British infantry were grateful?
Well, yes, I would have thought so.
Yeah. Bloody row. Oh, can't hear myself think. Anyway, some 35 of 65 15-inch shells fired at long range are reported to have hit the targets, and eight more were within 100 yards. And 100 yards, I wouldn't like to be 100 yards for a 15-inch shell. However, on 15th of September, the Warspite finally ran out of luck. Look.
At least you can say Paul.
When she was attacked by the Luftwaffe, including three Dornier. Dornier's 217 bombers. And what are they armed with?
They're armed with very early guided bombs, Pete.
Oh dear.
Now once more you're going to be Captain Herbert Packer.
I am. At 2:30 p.m. the ship's lookout sighted what were first thought to be three high level bombers at about 6,000 feet. They were actually wireless controlled bombs whose controlling aircraft were far away overhead at 20,000 feet. The three bombs turned vertically down and dived for the ship at great speed. From the time of the sighting to the time of the bomb's arrival was only some 7 to 10 seconds.
Ooh. Mm.
Well, one 3,000-pound bomb was a direct hit. Two just missed. One of them caused some damage to the side. But one of them hit just the stern of the aircraft hangar, penetrating through to the boiler rooms. And you're going to be Chief Petty Officer J.W. Suter. The Warspite.
It seemed as if an express train travelling at high speed had hit the ship. One tremendous explosion which seemed to jar every nerve in one's body. The ship seemed as if it had been picked up by some devilish hand, then dropped. Dust was everywhere, and most of the crew rushed to the upper deck. A second explosion occurred, followed by more intense shuddering, which must have been the bombs exploding in the region of the boiler rooms.
Now, so on the bridge,
it's staggering, isn't it? It's just the impact staggering, and I'm going to be Captain Herbert Packer. I was not thrown off my feet, but for a fraction of a second had a kind of blackout, like when you take a hard toss at football or off a horse. But I could see and think perfectly clearly all the time. Black smoke and dirt from the funnel and a hell of a noise. Thought the whole mast was coming down as it rocked, bent and whipped. For a moment I thought we were probably sunk and was quite prepared for the ship to break in two. No one lost their heads or shouted or anything on the bridge. They were all first class, and the anti-aircraft guns, which had opened fire, kept firing. That was good. Now, where was she hit?
Well, she's badly hit near the funnel, the bomb cutting through her decks and making a 20-foot hole in the bottom of her hull. Now, this cripples her, and although there were only 23 casualties. Now, the Warspite once more begin circling.
Now, we haven't made a big thing with it. The Warspite's steering's been dodgy, but once again, she's going round in circles. We've heard that before at Jutland, haven't we? And I'm Captain Herbert Packer. A fire was reported in the hangar. "Put it out," I said. "Then to guns. If we can steam and shoot, we'll carry out our final bombardment." I kept going at 6 knots. Then the ship would not steer. We were in the swept channel and we steered in a circle. I stopped the engine. We were heading straight for the mines. A minesweeper sent us violent signals to get out of it. I couldn't, for the helm was hard over. And finally, the starboard engine room died out too. So there we were, once again, going round in circles and quite helpless.
Now, she doesn't hit the mines.
No.
And with some 5,000 gallons of seawater inside her, she was towed off in near-sinking condition.
Oh, dear. Very difficult journey. How she doesn't sink, I don't know. She got back to the UK in March 1944 and was sent to Rosyth, opposite Edinburgh, for repairs. What happens this time?
Well, her 6-inch guns are removed, the gaps in the sides plated in, and a concrete caisson covered the hole left by the German bomb.
They're basically concrete up the bottom.
Yeah, now one of the boiler rooms in the X turret could not be repaired and indeed was out of action for the remainder of her career.
So she's a bit of a cripple now, I'm afraid. Crippled ship. She left Greenock on the 2nd of June 44. Well, I wonder why are they trying to get her into action?
Well, that's a quick turnaround, isn't it? She leaves it with 6 15-inch guns, 8 4-inch anti-aircraft guns and 40 pom-poms, and she joins Bombardment Force D of the Eastern Task Force of the Normandy Invasion Fleet off Plymouth on the 4th of June.
Ready to go into action. Thus it is on D-Day, 6th of June, at 5 o'clock in the morning. Warspite, well, she has a particular honour. What's that?
Well, she's often given the honours, and on this occasion she has the honour to be the first ship to open fire, bombarding the German battery at Villaville from a position 26,000 yards offshore in support of the landing by the 3rd Division on Sword Beach.
We've been there. Yeah.
We have.
Now, you're going to be Seaman Dennis Spencer, who's on the Warspite.
Our target was an important gun battery above Trouville. We had some anxious moments as the battery straddled us with a salvo, but our first one was the only one necessary as far as they were concerned. The rest of the day was spent shelling batteries, troops and a convoy of motor transport on a road. We silenced all our targets except one gun, which the RAF finished off for us. We fell out for supper, but closed up again throughout the night. We had our meals such as they were in the turret.
Now, she's carries these bombardment duties, carries on firing on the 7th of June. She fires some 300 shells, that's a lot, in 2 days. Then nips back to get some more shells, so comes back, and then moves over on the 9th of July to support the Americans.
9th of June, Pete.
9th of June. Sorry, I do apologise. It was a bad time to take my glasses off, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
9th of June. Stupid me. There's the wrong date, Gary. To support the Americans at Utah Beach. 11th of June, she supports 69th Brigade at Gold Beach. We've been there as well. 12th of June, goes back to Portsmouth to get more ammunition. But her guns are worn out, aren't they? Worn out. So what happens next?
Well, she's ordered to sail to Rosyth via the Straits of Dover.
Hang on a minute. That's not many ships have been going through the English Channel, have they?
No, she's the first British battleship to have done that since the war began.
What can go wrong to Lucky Warspite? I'm sure you're going to say she's no trouble at all.
No, she manages to evade the German coastal batteries.
Ah, I see. I told you she was lucky.
Well, this is partly due to effective radar jamming.
So through without any damage at all. That's lucky.
Yeah, she hits a mine 28 miles off Harwich early on the 13th of June.
I can just imagine them. Oh dear, so you're going to be Seaman Dennis Spencer again.
We were congratulating ourselves on having got through all right when there was an explosion aft on port side. I'd just come out of A turret and felt the whole ship whip under the strain, and the old lady took a shot list to port. I went back into the turret, and then emergency stations was piped, so I went aft to the flight deck, where the rest of the crowd were gathered, fully expecting to have to walk over the side into a Carly float. After a while, we were told that the ship was steady and that we were underway, although a little low in the water.
Back into the dockyard then? Now, a propeller shaft's damaged as well. Got to replace the guns, and that takes till early August. Top speed now, have a guess what that is, 24 knots, 23 knots?
No, it's down to only 15 knots, and her only feasible role now is shore bombardment.
She's basically a floating battery, like a monitor, but, you know. She arrives at Ushant on the 25th of 1944 and attacks the coastal batteries there at Le Conquet and Pont-Saint-Mathieu.
That was on the 25th of August 1944.
Yeah, please. What did I say this time?
25th of...
I'm losing the will to live.
Now, this is during the battle for Brest, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Then with the Monitor Erebus, that's the First World War, the Monitor, yep. Interesting ship. She carries out a preparatory bomb around Le Havre, because there's a German garrison there holding out. What's her final task, a final military task?
Well, it's to support an Anglo-Canadian operation to open up the port of Antwerp, which that had been captured in early September, I believe, by clearing the Scheldt estuary.
Now, so that's at the other, so they can get through, because the Germans are on the other side of the estuary. We did something about that.
Just about to say, that rings a bell again. The islands there, I think.
South Knots as ours. They fired across, and remember the old forward observation officers went across?
And Valturan Island, I think it was.
Valturan Island, that's it. So her final, she bombards on Walcheren Island on the 1st of November 44 and goes back to Deal the next day. And that was the last time she fired her guns. Her war is effectively over. Always sad in a way. Her crew loved her. They must be a bit tired of being blown up, running into things. We missed out most of the collisions she had. Basically every two or three weeks she seems to have been in a collision. Dodge and Warspite. What happens to her after the war, Gary? Is it a tale of she, you know, made a museum ship or something?
Yeah, there were proposals to retain her as a museum ship, but the Admiralty approved the scrapping of Warspite in July 1946, and she sailed from Spithead into Portsmouth to have her guns removed.
Oh, so that's the end of the story then, isn't it?
Well, on the 19th of April 1947, Warspite departs Portsmouth.
Hang on. Why are you carrying on? We've finished, haven't we?
No, she departs Portsmouth for scrapping at Fast Lane. Now, on the way, she encounters a severe storm.
Lucky Warspite.
And loses her tugs. She dropped anchor in Mounts Bay, but she could not hold, and she ended up hard aground in Prussia Cove.
Wow. Yeah, that's the thing. It's almost an act of defiance. I mean, ships, let's make this clear, ships do not have a personality. But if you attribute a personality, the Warspite is afraid.
Yes. Now, the hull's too badly damaged to allow her to be refloated. And by the summer of 1955...
I was born in... Oh, no, I wasn't. I was born in 1950.
It had broken up for salvage. Now, many of her old crew, they'd have an annual pilgrimage to the site of the wreck with a sort of commemorative memorial placed on shore in the 1990s. They'd gather to toast their old ship in a pub decorated with wood panelling from the Warspite.
Now, one sad thing is that very few people who served on the Warspite are still alive now. They'd be in their late 90s, wouldn't they?
I can't work it out. Sadly, they're mostly all long gone.
Well, that's what a ship she was. I mean, as I say, ships don't have personalities, but it's almost as if she did. Now, We want to make clear that we've used various sources. If you want to read more about the war spy, the first book I would recommend is Oscar Parks' British Battleships, mainly because it's the best book on battleships you'll ever get. It's wonderful. You can get one for about 40 to 50 quid. But what about the war spy? Well, the best book is by Stephen Roskill, HMS War Spy, The Story of a Famous Battleship. 1950s book, I love it. But there's three other books we consulted. What were they, Gary?
Well, Ian Ballantyne, HMS War Spy, The Fighting Life of the Royal Navy's Bravest Battleship.
Battleships aren't brave. But there you go. So that gives you a bit of an
idea. I think he's making reference to the crew there, yeah, isn't he?
All right. And then another one?
Harry Plevy, Battleship Sailors, The Fighting Career of HMS War Spy, Recalled by Her Men.
Yeah.
Is that an oral history book, Pete?
No, it isn't really. And a lot of the quotes are taken from Roskill. But it's still useful, still nice, but they're all nice books. And finally, the book that I got nowhere with, because it's technical, Ross Walton, Battleship War Spy, Anatomy of the Ship. I just didn't understand it. It's all plans and things.
I'll explain it to you later.
Yeah. Will you draw me a diagram?
I'll draw you a diagram.
We will be posting this with a picture of HMS War Spy, which I personally drew, imagining passing through Delville Wood in 1916.
And I took the Michael of that until I actually saw a picture of the real war spy, and you've got it remarkably accurate.
It is an accurate drawing.
It is.
It looks like a four-year-old's drawn it, but it is accurate. Well, I've really enjoyed that. War. I made a model of it when I was about 18, and it was a proud moment as I finished off the final bit.
Well, I'm sure the listeners will agree that that was an error-free podcast.
I feel I made no mistakes at
all. Neither of us, and your young boy seaman was interesting.
Yeah.
Ha, ha. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?